Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
Day 11 of witness testimony in the Derek Chauvin v. State of Minnesota trial occurred on April 12th, with what is likely to be the last day of the prosecution's case. Before the jury was seated, there were three issues discussed. The first was raised by the defense and argued that the prosecution's intended use of force expert would be repetitive, or cumulative, to use the legal term. Judge Cahill determined that video play would be limited while the witness was testifying. The second issue, also raised by the defense, related to a witness that was subpoenaed, Maurice Lester Hall, who had previously invoked the Fifth Amendment. This time the defense wanted to admit testimony that Mr. Hall provided while he was detained. The defense argued his statements should be admissible because they aligned with his interests and could therefore be considered trustworthy. The state argued his statements were self-serving and were therefore not trustworthy. The state also has no incentive to offer Mr. Hall immunity because the prosecution doesn't benefit from his testimony at all. So there's some purposeful strategy on behalf of the prosecution to inhibit his testimony to the extent that they can. The defense cited some case law, and Judge Cahill eventually agreed to review and issue an order later in the day around 1 p.m. The third issue, again raised by the defense, stems from a distinct event that occurred in Brooklyn Center, a suburb directly north of Minneapolis, where a cop murdered a 20-year-old black male named Dante Wright, who was pulled over for expired license tabs and eventually shot by an officer in the chest. He allegedly had open warrants, although the severity of these warrants isn't clear at the time. The defense requested that the jury be sequestered to avoid exposure to another round of protests and curfews. Judge Cahill determined that sequestration was not appropriate because the act of sequestration would further raise that this was an important event that the jury should take into account and would cause some sort of security concern amongst the jury. So his basic determination was they will not be sequestered. The first prosecution witness is Dr. Jonathan Rich. He's a cardiologist in Northwestern University. He has not testified previously. He did not get paid, but he is getting paid $12,000 a day to be physically in the courtroom and not at work. He discussed some of his medical background. He runs a fellowship program at the University of Chicago. He specializes in heart transplant cardiology. He works with mechanical heart pumps in a leadership position. He's a program director of the fellowship training program. He's an expert in cardiology, where cardiology is the study of the heart. Once the background introduction was over, the question jumped straight to, how did George Floyd die?
Have you formed any opinions in this case to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to the cause of Mr. Floyd's death?
Yes, I have.
Would you tell us your opinion or opinions?
Sure. In this case, Mr. George Floyd died from a cardiopulmonary arrest. It was caused by low oxygen levels, and those low oxygen levels were induced by the prone restraint and positional asphyxiation that he was subjected to.
There was then discussion about the mechanical system of the heart and the alveoli in the lungs, which are the grape-like structures in the lungs that Tobin talked about. This is where the gas exchange occurs. He's basically laying the medical background. He describes how the heart mechanically works. It's really two pumps. One pump pumps oxygenated blood and the other pump pumps deoxygenated blood. The purpose of this pump is to exchange and expel CO2 from your body. When most people think about the heart, they think about the left side of the heart, which is pumping the oxygenated blood into the body. He said that the left side gets all the glory, but the right side has an important role because it's expelling CO2 from the body. He introduces the nuance that the heart just pumps blood, and the oxygenation in the blood is not something that the heart cares about. It's just pumping. It's better to think about the two pumps in terms of where the blood originates from. You have blood originating from the lungs, which should be oxygenated, and you have blood originating from the rest of the body, which should be deoxygenated. He next got asked, what caused the low levels of oxygen in George Floyd's blood? And he simply stated that it was the prone restraint. He was simply unable to get enough oxygenated blood, or blood that would come from the lungs and should be oxygenated, but was not, because of the prone restraint. He stated that the low oxygen was caused by positional asphyxia. The prosecution then frames the general question of, was there a heart-related contribution to George Floyd's death? Was there a potential second cause of a drug overdose?
Did you reach an opinion or conclusion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to whether either of those two causes explain Mr. Floyd's death?
Yes, I did.
Would you tell us your opinion?
Sure. After reviewing all of the facts and evidence of the case, I can state with a high degree of medical certainty that George Floyd did not die from a primary cardiac event, and he did not die from a drug overdose.
After basically asserting that George Floyd did not die of anything heart-related or drug-related, the discussion moves to, how do you know this? They discuss what material he looked at. The witness states there are medical records, videos, autopsy reports, a history of existing medical conditions, hypertension, anxiety, substance abuse. There's some discussion about EKG and medical records. There wasn't any evidence of a heart injury in the medical records. George Floyd apparently had a strong heart that was able to pump blood with sufficient pressure, and there wasn't evidence of any cardiac problems in the medical records. There was evidence of high blood pressure, but high blood pressure isn't a heart condition. It's a blood vessel thing. It's the amount of pressure in basically the plumbing. He then intentionally says, I'll pause there, which demonstrates a pretty great understanding of the theater of the testimony, where he's answering the question as asked. He's not providing more information, and he's allowing the narrative that's going to be established by the prosecution to play out in whatever fashion they deem most appropriate, and he's merely an actor contributing to their objectives. The next question then leads to, isn't having a strong heart good? The witness basically says, it might be a really good thing, but over the long period of time, the muscle can tire out, and that's why we have to care about high blood pressure. While it's not a heart condition, it does interact with how the heart pumps blood over a long period of time, and it can have long-term effects. But it doesn't mean that the heart was incapable of pumping blood at a static moment in time. The discussion then moves to what is PEA and systole. These terms were first introduced by the two EMTs that testified earlier. PEA is pulseless electrical activity, and a systole is basically the absence of any electrical activity in the heart. So this witness is intending to establish from a medical point of view, with very specific and a high amount of training, that these two terms are relevant to this situation and explain why they occurred. He talks about how PEA is typically caused by hypoxia, and it's effectively a chaotic heart rhythm where the heart doesn't really know what to do because it's not getting signals from the brain because there isn't oxygen in the brain. He pantomimes rhythmless heart waves by using his fingers kind of like a piano. It's little subtle fluttering. And PEA can be caused by multiple things. It's caused by something, is his point. And if you can identify it, you can reverse it. And hypoxia is the most likely outcome or most likely cause of PEA. So when you're dealing with somebody that's on PEA, the protocol is to provide oxygen. Time is of the essence, and you can't always undo PEA. But you can if you get to it quickly enough and you determine what the cause is and basically correct it. It was not a heart attack. There's some subtle jab at what is a silent heart attack, and he scoffs at the question, but then he does elaborate that it happens with people who have diabetes, and that in George Floyd's case, there was no silent heart attack. He next got asked the direct question of, did George Floyd die a sudden death? And he responds with, no, it was a gradual death. We're done with that line of questioning, and it moves on to the autopsy reveal. He starts by discussing what he did not find, which mirrors the testimony of Dr. Baker on the previous day, where he said an autopsy is generally useful to identify what wasn't the cause of death. So the prosecution starts there and is going to effectively lead down the path of what didn't cause George Floyd's death. So the witness says he did not find that there was any heart issues. The heart was architecturally fine. He had coronary artery disease, which was notable. But it's not surprising because so many people have it. It's not an odd or peculiar thing. There wasn't evidence of platelets from a heart attack, and platelets occur in the heart, and you can observe that a heart attack occurred because of the presence of platelets. It's a response of the body to a heart attack to attempt to repair whatever the damage is. He then states that coronary artery disease was excluded with a high medical certainty as being the cause of George Floyd's death. He compliments the autopsy by saying that the pathologist did a very good job on describing the endocardium of the heart. There wasn't evidence of a previous heart attack, and there were no complete blockages. The discussion then moves to the size of George Floyd's heart, because this was an area where the defense attempted to poke holes in George Floyd's health by saying that his heart was too big, and therefore that's why he died. The cardiologist witness basically says the heart was mildly large. When there is blood pressure, it typically causes the heart to grow. So because of high blood pressure, the heart has to pump more, and it naturally just gets larger to compensate. So it's a natural response to high blood pressure. The problem did not originate in the heart, and now we move on to drug use. So both fentanyl and meth were considered.
As far as I can tell from reviewing all of the facts of the case, I see no evidence at all to suggest that a fentanyl overdose caused Mr. Floyd's death.
He cites two reasons as to why he can make this assertion. The first is that he had a high degree of tolerance for a drug use. He took 8 Percocets within 2 hours and was generally okay. And the other is that there was no signs of a fentanyl overdose on the video. When people have fentanyl overdoses, they become extremely lethargic, they have slurred speech, and the witness stated that he saw the opposite of that with Mr. Floyd. There's no substantive role that fentanyl played at all in his death. Same line of questioning about meth, but he basically says that it was a relatively low level of meth and didn't contribute at all. The prosecution then asks whether Mr. Floyd's death was preventable.
Well, at the time that Mr. Floyd is determined to have not had a pulse, what is your opinion, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, as to what Mr. Chauvin may have done that would have potentially saved his life?
Overall, you can give an opinion.
Well, just prior to that point, I heard one of the officers actually ask, actually on two occasions, if Mr. Floyd should be turned on to his side. And the response was, no, just leave him. And once the officer announced that he did not have a pulse anymore, I think he actually said he does not have one, was the exact words. At that point, the immediate response would then be to not only relieve him of the restraint, but at that point, now you've got to start CPR. You've got to start immediate chest compressions, because we know that if you can get to a patient right away, even when they've lost their pulse, even when they've gone into a cardiopulmonary arrest, there is a significant opportunity to save a life. But for every minute that transpires that you are not performing the basic life support and CPR measures, the literature would suggest an approximately 10 to 15% less chance of survival.
The prosecution then asked a question about what was his chance of resuscitation in an ambulance, and his response is very low. He counted the number of minutes and applied this 10 to 15% statistic and kind of just started rambling at that point, and the defense objected and said that this is not responsive and it was sustained. This was the end of the prosecution's direct, but they started throwing questions kind of at the wall to see what would stick. First question is, would George Floyd have lived for another 9 minutes in the absence of Chauvin on his neck? And the witness says, I believe he would have lived. Fairly straightforward and direct question. And then he attempted to take that question and make it more general and say, how about any person? And this line of questioning got objected to twice, so he stopped. And that was the end of the direct examination, and a 20-minute recess occurred. Nelson's first question, the cross-examination, raised the 90% artery blockage number that was raised during the autopsy. And the cardiologist basically responded by saying, this doesn't matter because the body will build arteries around the blockage to basically circumvent where the blockage occurs. So if the blockage occurs slowly, the body has an ability to work around it if everything else is healthy. And that appears to be what the cardiologist is suggesting in this circumstance. And Nelson quickly understood that this was a bad path to go down, so he immediately asked, what is a safe amount of meth? The doctor replied by saying that meth on the street is not safe, illicit meth isn't safe. The way that meth affects the heart is context dependent. Over a long period of time, it can contribute to coronary artery disease. Meth basically makes the heart work harder. Nelson sees that this is sort of another dead end, so he moves on to the paraganglioma, which was the tumor-like mass that was benign that was discovered in George Floyd's kidney area. Dr. Rich states that this mass was incidentally picked up in the autopsy. Based on the medical records, there's no evidence that it caused anything negative. Based on the medical records, which date back to 2018, he was prescribed high blood pressure medicine, but this is pretty much unlikely to be linked to this paraganglioma. He's then asked, do you ever remove paragangliomas? And he says, sometimes you remove them. There just isn't a lot of information about this paraganglioma, and the defense is just trying to tease out some sort of causality that really doesn't exist medically. Nelson then turns back to meth and asks, would you prescribe meth? And the doctor says, I don't prescribe amphetamines. I prescribe stimulants, and I would never recommend meth off the street. So this is the exact answer that Nelson wants, but it's also a brain-dead obvious answer that doesn't really require a medical degree. There's some discussion about the prone position, and Dr. Ridge basically says that it's not inherently dangerous by itself. In fact, some people in the ICU are put in the prone position because it helps them breathe and is a desperate attempt to save them, but it does require a respirator in that it helps you breathe because it opens up certain segments of the lungs. This, again, wasn't the answer that Nelson wanted, because he wanted that the prone position was totally fine, and to raise this COVID concept of, well, during COVID, some people are put in the prone position intentionally, and that's good. And the final question of the cross-examination deals with, once the heart stops, can they continue to respire? And this is called agonal breathing. And Dr. Rich states that this can last for several seconds. Jerry Blackwell then returns for the redirect. His first question is whether blockage is an appropriate term. The witness states that it's appropriate when there is a complete blockage, as in nothing can get through, but it's better to use narrowing when there is a restriction in flow. So the statement of 90% blockage is a loaded term to some degree. It should be a 90% narrowing is the intent of this line of questioning. And even though there is a narrowing, the collateral vessels, which are the vessels that grow in response to a blockage or a narrowing, can't provide enough blood even when there is a full blockage. Just because one artery or vein is fully blocked doesn't mean that there's not blood flowing in the path of the blockage due to a secondary route of some sort. There's an attempt to discredit the entire paraganglioma line of questioning, which was really pretty benign to begin with. Questions about, were there evidence of a headache, because that's apparently a symptom. Dr. Ridge says, no, I searched through the medical records and there never was. It's sometimes called an incidental loma. That's a reiteration of what Dr. Baker called it. Paraganglioma deaths are classified as very low. They don't occur frequently. Then we get back to the direct medical questions. Of all the various issues, was there damage to the heart muscle? And Dr. Rich says, absolutely not. Nelson then returns for a brief question.
But in terms of the combination, the drugs, the high blood pressure, take the paraganglioma out of it, right? The increase in adrenaline from a struggle with officers. All of those things combined together, even in the absence of prone restraint, could have resulted in death. Yes or no, sir?
Upon my review of the evidence and the facts of the case, I found no evidence to support that.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Which is a really stupid question for Nelson to ask, because he got no. After Dr. Rich's testimony concluded, Judge Cahill ruled on the Maurice Hall admissibility of the questionnaire and determined that he will not testify and that the questionnaire is not admissible.
The statements that are contained in the question and answer statement are, in fact, not the type that would clearly be so far contrary to the declarant's penal interest or subject that person to criminal liability that they would not make them unless true. Most importantly, for example, Mr. Hill totally denies providing controlled substances to George Floyd. He talks about how he was appearing tired and all that, but the entire statement seems to be Mr. Hall describing what does not incriminate him. He's willing to do that, but when it comes to anything that he might have done, he denies engaging in any activity like dealing. There are some sporadic references to dealing on the street, but there's nothing specific as to time, date, location, persons involved, that the person would be subjecting themselves clearly to criminal liability. Accordingly, it does not fall under 804b3. Under 807, a statement not specifically covered by Rule 803 or 804 may be admitted, but it must have equivalent circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness. I see nothing internally within the question and answer statement that Mr. Hall's statements had any guarantees of trustworthiness, and accordingly it is not admissible under the rule for that reason. The defense does have a right to a complete defense, but since there are witnesses who can testify as to what and have testified as to what Mr. Floyd looked like at the time, I don't think that the rules of evidence must give way completely to any claim of this evidence is necessary for a complete defense. I find it is not, and accordingly it is not admissible.
The next witness called by the prosecution was George Floyd's brother, Felonious Floyd, and he is going to give the spark of life testimony. The spark of life testimony is a concept unique to Minnesota, where typically a family member has an opportunity to discuss the victim. There is some risk if the witness discusses some previously undiscovered information, such as illicit actions or something that was previously not disclosed. The defense does have an opportunity to cross-examine, and it could open the door to further evidence or present new information that can be used by the jury in their verdict. In general, this testimony was absolutely soul-crushing. It started out by having Felonious lay out who he is, what his interaction with George Floyd was, what their upbringing was. A number of pictures were shown of George Floyd as a child, George Floyd with Felonious. He got through some of the very basic demographic information, started talking about when his mom died and how crushed George was, and then he basically broke down on the stand and just started crying.
Going back to growing up in the CUNY homes, can you please tell the jury what role George Floyd had as the older brother in that household?
He was so much of a leader to us in the household. He would always make sure that we had our clothes for school. He made sure that we all were going to be to school on time. And like I told you, George couldn't cook, but he'll make sure you have a snack or something to get in the morning.
He loved sports. He played football and basketball. He went to South Florida and then transferred to Texas A&M to play football after previously playing basketball at South Florida. There was a picture introduced of George Floyd doing homework. He was number 5 in a basketball uniform in another picture. He was always fit. He loved basketball.
We always went hooping.
And so they would play basketball together. They also would play football. They played catch. And Felonious was always wondering why George Floyd was so bad at football because he couldn't throw. But he came to understand that George was intentionally throwing it away from Felonious so that he'd have to go get it. He could learn to catch balls that weren't directly thrown at him. Talked about how George was a father, picture of his daughter Gianna, who was 7. Then the discussion turned to his relationship with his mother and how crushed George Floyd was when he died and how he didn't make it to Houston before she died and he was just crushed at the funeral. He didn't want to leave. He was just in pain the entire time. Felonious revealed that the last time he saw George Floyd was at his mom's funeral. He stated that they would frequently call and text. They would often talk in the early morning because Felonious is a truck driver, and they would just talk and listen. And the final question of the spark of life was,
Sir, and this is a yes or no question, were you informed that your brother George Floyd died on May 26, 2020?
Yes, sir.
The defense is then asked whether they have any questions, and they don't, because that's typically customary as part of the spark of life testimony, is that the defense doesn't ask any questions. This was fucking soul-crushing to watch. The working class just got absolutely fucked and nobody cares. Fuck Chauvin, fuck cops, fuck Nelson. The whole system is just absolute trash, and George Floyd got absolutely fucked over, and so did the whole family. The prosecution's next and probably last witness was a use of force expert named Seth Stoughton. Steve Slisher is doing the examination for the prosecution. Seth is a law professor at the University of South Carolina and literally wrote a book entitled Evaluating Police Use of Force. He is not a bootlicker like the previous use of force expert from Louisville PD. His background story is generally interesting, and he seems to have a genuine interest in mitigating police abuse. He attended Florida State University and received a degree in English while working as a Tallahassee police officer. He earned his law degree from the University of Virginia. The prosecution is attempting to frame this witness as a real police officer that doesn't just sit in an ivory tower and speculate about how police should act. He's actually been a police officer. Seth stated that he didn't have any ambitions to become a use of force expert, but realized that he had relevant experience having worked as a real cop. He's written law review articles, books, and presented at over 100 conferences. He has trained actual police forces, including the ATF. He has been an expert witness about 60 times. He's done at least 12 civil depositions, including federal trials in the South. He is not doing this for free. His rate is $295 an hour with an 8-hour minimum. He's been compensated roughly $25,000 and has worked roughly 130 to 140 hours. As part of formulating his conclusion, he reviewed 10,000 plus pages, body cameras, and the bystander videos. He stated that he frequently views body camera video as part of research and training. He noted that unlike other cases, there was ample video of this incident, and that allows him to have a better idea of what was happening and where throughout the entire course of the incident. While reviewing the video, he makes the first reference to the Speedway video that was introduced on day one. He reviewed all the various videos and stated that viewing one angle aids in understanding all of the others. The prosecution then moved on from the demographic questions and began asking the formulaic questions about did you form an opinion, and the witness responds yes. The prosecution then begins to quantify what the reasonable use of force is. The witness references Graham versus Connor, which is the legal constitutional standard, which defines the reasonableness of using force. Seth begins to detail his criteria when assessing whether force is reasonable. He says there's three parts. There's ability, opportunity, and intention. He uses an example of somebody changing a tire with a tire iron and goes through the various permutations that would require all three to be present in order for there to be a threat. A threat is what is necessary in order for there to be a reasonable use of force. As an example, one of the permutations is that an individual is standing near an officer with a tire iron, but they're changing the tire. So they have the ability because they're holding the tire iron. They have the opportunity because they're near an officer, but they don't have the intention to actually injure or harm the officer because they're changing a tire and they don't have intent. There is no intention. Then he introduces the concept of risk, which is really just a potential threat.
The goal is to prevent risk from becoming threat and really to prevent threat from becoming whatever that relevant harm is. But while threat can justify use of force, risk can't. An officer can't use force on someone who's holding a tire iron and 2 or 3 feet away while they're just changing a tire because there's no apparent intention, there's no threat there. The officer can do something like back away, build distance so they aren't 2 or 3 feet away, or interpose the vehicle between themselves and the individual they're interacting with, or use communications. They could ask the individual to put the tire iron down. But they can't use force there because there's no threat.
As part of evaluating risk, the severity of the crime could be taken into consideration. The environment is relevant, as is the behavior of the subject. He uses the example of the size of a person. Size is a risk factor, but not a threat. The size of a person can't establish intent, similar to how drug use can also not establish a threat. If somebody has committed a very severe crime, that can weigh into the assessment of a threat or intention of a threat. The discussion then moves to defining what resistance is. Seth defines there to be three levels before a threat occurs. You have passive resistance, and the best example is somebody just lying down. You have active resistance, which requires muscles to resist, and then active aggression is next. Then there can be an actual threat that justifies force. Officers must also take into account the foreseeable effects of their actions, and this is encapsulated in the Minneapolis Police Department's decision-making model, where they're constantly weighing environmental changes. Seth says that his opinion isn't specific to the Minneapolis model, but it's the general premise that force is a spectrum and should be based on information that is known at the time to the officer. The prosecution then shifts and starts presenting exhibits and walks through the body camera video, starting with the initial attempt to place George Floyd in the back of the SUV. Seth states that George Floyd was actively resisting but was not exhibiting aggression. He therefore wasn't a threat per the resistance continuum he discussed earlier. When George Floyd passes through the car and onto the ground and is placed in the prone position, he is not a threat because he doesn't have opportunity.
Now, I need to ask you, at the time that he was placed prone, when this use of force was done, was Mr. Floyd a threat?
So again, threat is specific, but I don't see him presenting a threat of anything. He was not a threat of harm to the officers.
even to the extent he had physical ability, he didn't have much in the way of opportunity to assault or harm the officers. And just as importantly, there's no specific and articulable facts that an officer, a reasonable officer in the defendant's position, could use to conclude that he had the intention of causing physical harm to the officers or others.
Progressing forward in time to Lane's camera, it's established that Lane did not perceive a threat when he suggested rolling George Floyd on his side. Chauvin responds with, "Stay put." There's a similar interaction with a bystander where the pulse check is requested. In this situation, the officer did not identify foreseeable effects of their actions. A reasonable officer would have assessed that pressure to the neck can cause serious injury. The effects of the prone position and positional asphyxia have been known for at least 30 years. And you can see evidence of the foreseeable effects when you hear George Floyd say, "I can't breathe," multiple times. As the video plays forward, Chauvin ignores medical distress and pleas for help.
So the first thing you hear is one of the bystanders say he's passed out or something like that, and that's echoed by one of the officers who says he's passing out. As we're assessing, threat, if we can jump back to that for a second, someone who's passing out obviously does not present a threat.
Officer King would check the pulse twice and not find one, to which Chauvin responded, "Huh." Lane then says at some point that George Floyd is not responsive. Somebody that is non-responsive cannot be a threat. Bystanders at this point also continue to ask for a pulse, and eventually George Floyd is loaded into the ambulance and the restraining period ends. This is the conclusion of the exhibit walkthrough. There's then a recess. Upon returning from the recess, the prosecution attempts to summarize everything that was just said during the exhibit review. A reasonable officer would not perceive a threat. The crowd was not a threat. Chauvin walked by the crowd and returned to his car, where he eventually has a discussion with Charles McMillan. While Chauvin is talking to Charles McMillan, he states that George Floyd was a big guy, which, as established earlier, does not establish a threat, and therefore does not justify the use of force. So based on Chauvin's reasoning that George Floyd was a big guy, there is no justification for the use of force based on Seth Stoughton's criteria. The discussion then shifts to rendering aid. Seth says it's the highest duty. Officers are not paramedics, but they can't presume people are lying about medical distress. There are also other signs of medical distress. In this situation, bystanders are asserting medical issues. There's physical evidence. His voice is changing. He's losing consciousness. There's no pulse. All of these are indicators of medical distress. The prosecution then concludes by asking a series of expert witness questions that are very formal. They all have the date. They're all preceded by the, "Have you come to a reasonable degree of certainty that X, Y, and Z?" And each time the witness responds, "Was the force deadly force?" "Yes." "Was the force reasonable?" "No." "When did the unreasonable force start?" "At the time of the prone position when the knee was placed on George Floyd's neck." "When did it end?" "When the knee was removed." "Was the restraint reasonable?" "No reasonable officer would have believed the force was reasonable." "Was the force unreasonable for its entire duration?" "Yes." "Was medical aid rendered appropriately?" "No, it was contrary to standard police practices." And that concludes the prosecution's direct examination. Nelson's cross-examination begins by attempting to frame the witness as an academic, not a cop. Seth responds by stating it's a professional standard as defined by Graham, and his position as an academic has nothing to do with this. Nelson doesn't really seem to grasp that he's crossing a lawyer. Nelson tries to frame all of this testimony as a hindsight analysis, but the witness states that the analysis is done from the perspective of a reasonable officer with an objective lens to the information available in the moment. Nelson asks a leading question about an officer taking into account their training, but the witness states that he doesn't care about training. He's looking at outcomes of actions. Nelson responds with his standard fair enough response that typically indicates he shouldn't have walked down that line of questioning. There's then some discussion about training and past experiences, and Seth agrees that all that factors in. There's an attempt to re-raise that people fake medical issues to get out of being arrested because people don't actually like being arrested. Seth asserts that only medical professionals can assess whether this happened, and it shouldn't have any bearing on what the action of the cop is in the given situation because they can't know. Nelson then moves into this weird hypothetical that makes no sense. The witness asks to repeat the question, and it still doesn't make sense. Listening to the recording again, it still doesn't make sense. As best I can tell, it has something to do with an individual being in the car and somehow hiding information about the other occupants in the car. The witness basically just says that I guess it's possible in theory, and then Nelson moves on. There's then a bunch of discussion about where Chauvin parked when he arrived and what he knew when he arrived. Part of this, I think, is Nelson poking at the witness and saying, well, you watched 140 hours of video or spent 140 hours of time on this. Do you know where Chauvin parked? And Seth responds with, yeah, but that doesn't mean I know what Chauvin knew when he arrived. Nelson tries to frame the entire situation as Chauvin entering this chaotic environment and that he just did the best that he could. We learned during this segment that there was actually a fifth officer at the scene for the Minneapolis Park Police. Seth made a vague statement to this during his direct examination, but the facts are more clearly laid out during the cross. There was a fifth officer across the street by the Dragon Walk with the two individuals that were in George Floyd's car. There's then more debate about what Chauvin did or didn't know and whether he could assume information from his partner or other officers was accurate. Nelson attempts to rehabilitate the suggestion that the prone position was not appropriate by citing previous use of force expert Jody Steiger, and Seth basically just says, nah, he's wrong. The prone position is supposed to be transitory. Seth Stoughton apparently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post on May 29th, which was 4 days after the incident. Nelson attempts to frame his comments in the op-ed as being pro-prone position, but Seth corrects this and asserts that he was pro-prone position during handcuffing, and that was the subject of the op-ed, and that the op-ed had limited information versus what we know now. Nelson then moves on and tries to frame the restraint as the knee on the neck, as not being the knee on the neck, but rather the back. The question was whether the knee was on the neck for the entire 9 minutes and 29 seconds, and Seth responds by saying that it's not relevant. The knee never should have been on the neck. At this point, Nelson starts throwing out the various tropes. George Floyd was big, EMS was slow, there was an angry mob. The witness states that the crowd was not a factor and that the officers should have known they were being recorded. The awful, but maybe lawful quote from Jody Steiger is inserted, and this witness just dismisses it as not being the case, implying that nothing that occurred was lawful. In response to a question, Seth raises that handcuffing somebody and maintaining control of somebody while handcuffed are completely different. The use of force continuum applies to either of those actions differently. There was then more discussion about the surroundings. Seth described 12 to 15 people by the bus stop. There were people across the street. The park officer is across the other street. He states that the cops need to be situationally aware and that the video is only captured what the camera sees. Nelson asks whether a reasonable officer can be distracted, and the witness says it can happen depending on the situation. Nelson then starts trying to list a series of distractions. There was EMS traffic on the radio. George Floyd was on drugs, and that needed to be considered. He raised that you can have superhuman strength when on drugs, which is the crack makes you a superhero trope. Seth generally agrees that drugs can have side effects. Nelson then attempts to discredit the witness's analysis by saying that he wasn't at the scene, he could analyze the video in slow-mo, the use of force analysis is not done in a dangerous situation. Nelson loops back around to whether the knee to the neck is deadly force in general, and Seth states that if it's transient, it's not deadly force. Nelson then attempts to introduce a hypothetical about whether a subject being handcuffed has the potential to run away. And this is an attempt to equate the risk of something happening with preemptively being able to use force to prevent it.
And in terms of a person who's handcuffed, it's not a reasonable officer would never expect that person to get up and run away or become a threat again?
That's not my testimony. My testimony is there may be some risk of that, but officers can generally maintain control over a handcuffed individual in the side recovery position, which is what it's designed for.
The cross-examination ends with Nelson asserting when George Floyd passed out, he was still breathing, and the witness agrees. On to the redirect. Schlisher raises the concept of using more force. The witness states that the concept is not helpful when explaining proportionality. Situational awareness of a reasonable officer would know that the subject is unconscious. The absence of a pulse would be incredibly important, and this all plays into the vicious cycle of positional asphyxia. The witness concludes by stating that I can't breathe should be evaluated in the context, and that the answer was to roll them onto the side into the side recovery position. Seth Stoughton is dismissed from the stand, and Judge Cahill provides some closing remarks. It is Cahill's expectation that Friday will be an off day, and closing statements will be made on Monday, April 19th. He states that the jury will be sequestered and that he doesn't want the sequestering to happen over the weekend. It also gives more time for the attorneys to prepare for closing. Cahill instructs the jury to pack a bag and recesses. The general expectation is that the prosecution will rest the following morning, but the idea is to have some extra time in the event of something unforeseen. The likely final day of prosecution witnesses represents a microcosm of the entire case so far. The day began with the defense complaining about there being too many witnesses saying the same thing without a hint of irony. Perhaps the facts of the case are so brain-dead obvious that everybody with any qualification has drawn the same conclusion. The medical case was concluded by a cardiologist, the emotional case was concluded by George Floyd's younger brother, and the appropriateness of the use of force was concluded by a cop turned lawyer. If there's anything to be learned from the prosecution's slate of witnesses, it's that there are many, many people willing to literally take the stand. The biggest problem of the legal and political system is that it does not provide an outlet for most people to assert their ability or willingness to take a stand without debilitating repercussions. This is by design. For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.